on our agenda today is House File 3679 from our own Representative Kraft. Representative Kraft, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I move that House File 3679 be recommended to be referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee.
Representative Kraft moves House File 3679 be recommended to be referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee, and you have an amendment, the A1 amendment. Would you like to move the A1 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I move the A1 amendment. It puts the bill in the manner I'd like it to be considered.
Discussion to the A1 amendment. Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the A1 is adopted. Representative Kraft, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this bill is really about consumer protections and consumer choice, and is probably even more impactful in greater Minnesota. As this is an agency bill, I'm going to ask John Kelly from Commerce to provide the details. I will just provide a little bit of background on that amendment that went in there. One of the things that the bill does is removes restrictions on municipalities offering their own communication services, such as broadband and internet access. The amendment was about making sure that there is a level playing field if this happens by keeping any regulatory function done by a municipality separate from communication service offerings. And this was brought to me by some of the telecom cable providers, and I thought that it made a lot of sense. So that's what that amendment was. So with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Kelly.
Thank you, Chair and members. For the record, my name is John Kelly. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Thank you to Representative Kraft for carrying House File 3679, which is the department's telecom policy bill. We're glad to work with Rep. Kraft and industry on some added language that the representative just went through to ensure that there is an even playing field in the event communities decide to develop their own broadband infrastructure. The bill proposes changes to Minnesota Statutes 237 and 429, which would result in improved telephone and internet service for Minnesota consumers. The bill does the following. It amends Minnesota Statutes 237.121 to require voice service providers to provide a prorated refund to customers who pay in advance but cancel their service before the end of their prepaid term. It creates a new provision in Minnesota Statutes 237 to include an automatic $25 account credit to customers who inform their provider that they have a known healthcare issue that requires consistent access to 911 emergency services if their provider fails to appear at that repair appointment as scheduled without 24 hours notice. And finally, it removes outdated language that limits local communities from developing infrastructure for broadband or high-speed internet connectivity. This would allow municipalities to develop infrastructure for connectivity, either for partnering with private internet service providers or developing municipal broadband utilities. It would also allow local governments to invest in any type of voice service. These provisions provide additional protections for all Minnesotans, but especially help elderly and rural Minnesotans, as well as those living with disabilities. Minnesotan voice customers will benefit from companies refunding their money for services they paid for but did not receive. And consumers who rely on voice service for emergency access to 911 services due to medical conditions, such as elderly Minnesotans or Minnesotans with disabilities, will be afforded statement credits if the voice service provider misses a scheduled repair appointment. This provides an incentive for the provider to honor service appointments and ensures consumers maintain access to vital, life-saving emergency services. All Minnesotans, but especially rural communities, can benefit from local government investment in or development of broadband voice access. That is the bill, and stand ready for any questions.
We'll move first to public testimony on the bill. We do have one person who signed up in advance, Brent Christensen from the Telecom Alliance. State your name for the record and proceed your testimony. Welcome back to the committee.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Brent Christensen, and I'm the president and CEO of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance. We are a trade association that represents cooperatives, family-owned companies, commercial companies, privately held and publicly traded throughout the state. I'm here to testify against House File 3679, and we oppose four of the issues that the bill addresses, and with your permission, I'd like to break those down. The first of the two parts of the bill applies to only landline telephone companies, which are mainly my members. And as I explained my membership, they are mainly small rural broadband providers throughout Main Streets, Minnesota. There is no other segment of the telecommunications industry that's going to be up here testifying against this bill because it doesn't apply to them. It only applies to us. And that's because We believe that it unfairly singles out MTA members. The type of billing this legislation is designed to prevent is commonplace in today's society. Telecommunications companies are just one industry that bills a full month in advance. And while passing a law prorating a bill may not seem like a big deal, it can drive costly changes to billing systems and networks, particularly to small companies. In addition, costs such as processing and mailing a check, and in some instances requiring a network technician to make a trip to a neighborhood terminal, need to be taken in consideration. These are now costs incurred only by MTA members and not our competitors. The missed repair appointment credit is another unfair and discriminatory expense that would affect MTA members and not our competitors. I understand the consumer protection motivation behind this language, but a $25 bill credit, which can be more than the cost of monthly landline telephone service and is added to regulatory burden to annual reporting requirements, are not going to achieve the desired outcome. This legislation also leaves a lot of questions unanswered, such as what happens when an appointment's missed due to weather, who makes the final decision on a bill credit if the customer doesn't answer the door, and what happens when a home visit is not necessary. Mr. Chairman and members, this law will only be applicable to landline telephone customers if enacted. And I'm willing to bet if you took a survey in this room right now, less than 10% of the people have a landline telephone, and of those, less than 50% have it from a company that this bill would apply to. The MTA is willing to work with the author and other stakeholders to come up with something that is actually would actually make a difference and ensure that people that need telephone service for their medical devices get reliable service regardless of their provider. Mr. Chairman, I know you're a big proponent of eliminating any barriers for municipal entries into the telecom business, but the way this bill is written, a simple majority of the vote of the Medillia City Council, where I live, could condemn and take my family's 120-year-old telephone company. How can that possibly be right or fair? And while we oppose to moving the language in lines 5.2 and 5.7, I understand that that amendment has been addressed here. I hadn't had a chance to see that. We do want to reinforce the need for having competitive competition, a competitively neutral environment. We don't object to competition. We live with it every day. We do object to unfair competition, and we hope that the amendment will address that. As long as there are protections for against cross-subsidization and firewalls between municipalities' regulation of their right-of-ways and competitive business. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you. So Mr. Christensen was the only person who signed up to testify in advance. I'll now ask any members of the public, and you can step down, Mr. Christensen. We'll call you back up if someone has a question. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify to the bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member questions and discussion. Discussion to the bill. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I must have a lot of extra time, no testifiers and no other member questions, because I got a list of them ready to go here. So let's just get started. First question that I have for the bill author, and maybe Mr. Kelly as well from the department, where did we arrive at $25 for a fee to provide a customer if the telecom company is not able to keep an appointment?
Mr. Kelly.
Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, that number was determined by the telecom unit at the department.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What are the provisions and the safeguards in the bill right now if the telecom company in good faith comes out and they ring the doorbell and the person on the other side requesting the service is not able to answer the door or accommodate their appointment with the telecom company? Does the telecom company get to charge them $25 too?
Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, again, the $25 credit, just to take a step back, is for a specific instance. If the Minnesotan voice service customer notifies the provider in advance that they have a medical condition that requires consistent access to 911 service and the appointment is missed, also, the telecom provider has the opportunity to provide notice in advance, 24 hours notice that they're going to miss the appointment, that they will have to do the credit. The consumer does not have to pay the company. I don't think that this is about a charge that would happen only if the provider did not notify the consumer that they weren't going to be able to come. I'm happy to, you know, talk with folks if there's additional language that needs to get added. We're open to that. We just accepted an amendment that was brought forth by industry. But this is something that if the provider is doing the right thing and letting folks know that they're not going to make it, that in this specific instance where they need consistent service, then there is this credit applied. This is not across the board for all consumers.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that same question, Mr. Kelly, I understand the isolated nature of the $25 fee. But I'm talking about when the telecom company, in good faith, keeps their appointment, but the customer is not there to let them in to provide service that's necessary to support the request, or in a situation where they arrive at premises and there's a vicious animal that's out there. This committee certainly has had discussion in the last couple of bienniums about the nature of dogs and dog bites and different kinds of things of that nature. And they just personally don't feel that their safety is in good keeping when they approach the property. What guarantees do they have that the other side is going to, in good faith, try to allow the property to be accessible?
Mr. Kelly.
Representative, I think that, again, you know, this is about, you know, I think there's a lot of stuff here we're talking about. This is specific to the appointment being missed. We have examples of someone having their appointment missed 8 times, multiple times. We have, and I don't have an answer for that. I will again say, without getting into many different hypotheticals that could be posed, that we're willing to take further amendments on this bill.
Yeah, and I'll add, the bill does, the motion was to refer to the state and local government committee, so there's at least one committee stop, and it may find its way back here eventually as well. So it sounds like the department would be willing to work with you on that, Representative O'Driscoll. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other part that's concerning is the two-thirds referendum requirement. I think that Mr. Christensen made an extremely important point, that we're choosing an industry and we're going to allow a majority vote of a 5-member city council. That'd be 6 to, out of 5 members on a city council. That'd be 3-2, a 1-vote majority, to be able to basically institute a new telecom communication system in the community run by the city, who probably doesn't have a lot of practical experience in being able to do that. But what they'll do is they'll just go ahead and condemn the current provider, acquire their assets to be sold, and most likely they'll purchase those assets. In other words, a taking of those assets from that telecom company who's been servicing that community. So there's bigger problems than that. The way that we've had evolution of services, that might have been a regional hub that particular provider had in the neighborhood, located in a community of, like, use the community of Vermilion. So it might be the hub for many telecoms around there. How are those providers who that company would still be allowed to do business in other communities but are basically being gutted with their facility in the home or whole city of Vermilion?
Representative Kraft.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, so I will say I don't, you know, having been on city council, we made many decisions, and I don't understand why this one would require something different than many of the other consequential decisions that a city government may need to make. So, yeah, I think that city councils have to carefully deliberate why they're going to do things. I think many cities would, in terms of getting into a situation like this, a big decision to go offer a telco service. So I don't understand why we would be requiring something different from most other city council decisions.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, Representative Kraft, this is a big decision. This is a huge decision. This is the telephone company in the community. It's not, gee, do we put a swing set in a park? 3-2, boy, that was a heck of a debate that we had. Or do we forge ahead with a major road infrastructure program? Had a pretty big debate, and what does it cost of selling bonds? A lot of deliberation should be going into this. Literally, we're telling a private sector business, we can decide 3-2, to run you out of business in our community if we so desire. The amount of political weight that you're putting in the hands of a city council to jeopardize all callers and all persons in that area is something that I wouldn't want to be involved with. Mr. Chair, looks like some folks want to respond to my comment here on the testifying table.
Mr. Kelly.
Thank you, Chair. And we agree that this is an important service. That's why we're bringing forward this bill, to provide consumer choice. There is nothing in statute in any other area that requires a supermajority vote by municipality. Chapter 117, which governs local government authorities' exercise of eminent domain, requires a vote of the local government unit. It does not say supermajority. When local governments condemn for other purposes, they are required to do the same public hearing that is currently required in 237.20, and they can also include the same right of appeal to the district court that is required in 237.20. And finally, the selling of the condemn and then the taking, there is a formal process to establish just compensation for the condemnation, and that is also appealable. So there's no other area in state statute that we have found besides this one that requires a supermajority. And so all we're doing is trying to level the playing field, and especially in areas where the law does not say that the municipality alone, it can also partner with a private industry to do this. So I understand the concerns, but this is an area where this is the only industry that has this type of requirement.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Kelly, to that point, and I thank you for articulating again all the ways that government is going to be able to take this private business, if it is chosen by the city council that they want to get into the business of not only being the regulator but being the provider of the regulated service at this point. And I too, Representative Kraft, have been involved in local government, and I would look at this as an overreach of government, because you know what happens is, let's say that we have only one or two gas stations in town or a service facility. We take our city vehicles there, but they're backed up with other people. What would prevent us from coming to the legislature and getting a law that says, well, you know, the city can now go in on a 3-2 vote and they can decide to condemn and take over the service station. So the city can always have people there that can repair the police cars and can repair everything else. Now, I see you're smirking, and I intended a little bit for that, Representative Kraft. But the idea is, you're taking a private business and you're publicizing that, right? You're going to take it from a private entity, and you're going to make it a public entity on a 5-member city council, 3-2 vote. No supermajority, as Mr. Kelly said. Just a simple, all those in favor, aye. All those opposed, nope. Okay, guess what? We're in the telecom business. Hey! And this family who has gone through, put this infrastructure in, has all this debt, has all of these liabilities, and have all the sweat and equity, are, well, what time can you be out of the offices? Because we're going to condemn and we're going to take it over. I'm strongly a no vote on this bill today.
I will just note there's nothing that requires a condemnation in connection with the city opening up a telecommunications business. I mean, that's not really what's contemplated here. And it is going to another committee, and I understand there'll be continuing discussions about that potential intersection between a city's condemnation power and this particular piece. So I'm sure that conversation will continue. Any further discussion to the bill? Seeing none, closing comments, Representative Kraft.
Yeah, I think this is a good bill. Consumer protections, and also gives communities that are not getting sufficient service another alternative to provide what is becoming increasingly a key service for their constituents. So I urge a yes vote.
Representative Kraft renews his motion that House File 3679, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and House File 3679, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. We will now go to House File 2021, also a Representative Kraft bill. Representative Kraft, would you like to move your bill?
I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 2021 be recommended to be placed on the General Register.
Okay. So Representative Kraft moves House File 2021 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. There is a DE amendment. Would you like to move your DE amendment?
I would. I move the DE-4. It's to get the bill most of the way into the form in which I'd like it to be considered.
All right. Representative Kraft moves the DE-4. And before we take action on that, we're going to consider an amendment to the DE-4, which maybe gets it the rest of the way to where you want us to consider it. Correct. Would you like to offer the A2 amendment to the DE-4?
I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that the A2 amendment to the DE-4 amendment. I move the A2 amendment to the DE-4 amendment, and this gets the bill the rest of the way into the form I'd like it to be considered.
All right. Discussion to the A2 amendment to the DE4. Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and the A2 amendment to the DE4 is adopted. Now to the underlying DE4 amendment. Discussion to the DE4 amendment. Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the DE4 amendment, as amended, is adopted. Representative Kraft, after all of that, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So I'm excited to be presenting this bill. I'm going to take you a little bit back through memory lane. Back in 1995, when the publicly funded backbone of the Internet was turned off, I actually was the product manager for Sprint's Internet service, which at the time carried more Internet traffic than any other in the U.S. And I actually helped negotiate the first bilateral interconnection agreement with MCI. And one of the things that that agreement was based on was neutrality and an open Internet. So the Internet was founded on this principle of neutrality, with Internet service providers, or ISPs, treating all data equally. Net neutrality is simply enshrining this idea in law that all Internet traffic must be treated equally. It's important because net neutrality prevents discrimination against content or services by ensuring that ISPs cannot block, throttle, or prioritize data based on their commercial interests. It safeguards an open and democratic online environment and is key to maintaining fair access to information and services for all users. It's also about fostering innovation and competition online in that it ensures a level playing field for businesses or anyone that wants to offer a service over the Internet. Without it, startups and smaller companies might be unable to compete against a larger corporation that could pay for faster access to users. Or an ISP could offer a competing service and prioritize its traffic. This has happened. After the FCC in the last administration repealed net neutrality in 2017, a couple of years later, AT&T openly advertised that cellular customers could stream the company's DirecTV Now product without it counting against monthly data caps, while any competing video service did count. Cellular carriers have throttled video services. A few years ago, Sprint throttled Skype. YouTube and Netflix were often frequent targets of throttling by several providers. So why should we do it at the state level? Certainly at this point, the FCC is considering it, and hopefully we'll take some action on it later this year, and so it could come back. But we've already seen how it was put in place and then undone by a different administration. There are 7 states that have passed net neutrality laws and several others that have supported it in different ways. At this point, I thought I'd briefly review the bill. Subdivision 1, 1.5 to 226 are definitions. And subdivision 2 is where net neutrality is required. Subdivision 3 in the DE amendment has been removed. We removed the requirement for providers to provide to do certifications. What was subdivision 4? Provides an exception for government services. And this is building on things that have been learned in other states. An example came up in another state that a telehealth application for veterans was being excluded from ISP data caps and that might run afoul of net neutrality. So we carve out government services from this to allow that to happen. Subdivision 5 is about making it, which is now 4, is about making it clear nothing in this bill supersedes emergency requirements. And the former subdivision 6 is about enforcement and has been simplified by the removal of lines 4.7 and 4.8, which are no longer needed with the removal of the certification requirement. So with that, I may have a testifier here.
I do.
I ask my testifier to come up.
Wonderful. If you just come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Hello, my name is Munira Mohammed, and I'm the policy associate for the American Civil Liberties Union. Thank you to the chair and members. So the ACLU is a longstanding organization devoted to preserving the individual rights and liberties enshrined in our Constitution. I'm here to speak in support of Representative Kraft's net neutrality bill. Net neutrality is a popular name given to the rules and regulations that kept the Internet free from censorship and content-based discrimination. The rules ensure that powerful internet service providers, ISPs, which provide our access to the internet, could not discriminate in favor of content that they liked and against content that they didn't. So regardless of an ISP's political views or business interests, a customer's access to lawful internet content could not be sped up, slowed down, or blocked. It's obvious to every adult and child that the internet has become a vital part of our everyday lives. Keeping it as a free and open medium is of the utmost importance. We all benefit when the internet remains a place where you can always access any lawful content you want and where entities delivering the content can't play favorites because they disagree with the message being delivered or want to charge money for faster delivery. Surveys as recent as 2022 have shown that a large majority of Americans, both on the right and the left, support the principles of net neutrality. So how did we get to the situation where it's under threat? On December 14, 2017, the FCC voted 3-2 to end net neutrality. This rollback of internet freedom was led by the FCC chairman, Ajit Pai, a former Verizon lawyer, and was justified in part by 8.5 million comments that the FCC received supporting the rollback, all of which later were revealed to be fraudulently submitted on behalf of the ISP companies, as of a report submitted by the New York State Attorney. The response to the rollback was immediate, including a Congressional Review Act, several executive orders by governance, and state legislation. Since 2017, there have been delays in federal government and the FCC in reinstating net neutrality. We currently don't know what the future of the internet will be, but Minnesota can act now and ensure that the ISP landscape is full of competition and innovation. The ACLU of Minnesota strongly believes that a free and open internet is a matter of First Amendment rights, and will work tirelessly to protect that for Minnesotans. We urge the committee to pass House File 2021.
Thank you. We'll now move to public testimony. We did have three members of the public sign up to testify. We'll start with Melissa Wolf from MCCA, followed by Brent Christensen. Ms. Wolf, state your name for the record. Proceed your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Melissa Wolf, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Minnesota cable companies are proud to serve residents of Minnesota in every corner of the state, providing a high-speed, reliable broadband connection to over 1.5 million residents in the metro, suburbs, and rural Minnesota. We are also proud to partner with the Office of Broadband Development through the Border to Border program. We appreciate the opportunity to testify today, and I do want to thank Representative Kraft for his amendment that removed the certification requirement and the perjury language. That is greatly appreciated. Unfortunately, I am still here today to ask the committee to vote against this bill. To be clear, MCCA member companies support an open internet and strictly adhere to net neutrality principles. We do not block, throttle, engage in paid prioritization, or unfair discrimination, and our consumer practices are transparent. Since net neutrality rules were repealed by the FCC, advocates cannot point to a single instance of a violation of net neutrality principles. In fact, broadband networks are faster, more widely deployed, more competitive, and more affordable. Under this bill, if a broadband provider and the Commerce Department have a disagreement over what constitutes reasonable network management, the department has the ultimate authority to decide what is reasonable and seek penalties against a broadband provider. The idea of having multiple states or even the FCC with different approaches to such highly technical regulatory subjects is very concerning to our industry. As Representative Kraft noted, the FCC is also poised to reinstate net neutrality rules later this year, given the inherent interstate and international nature of the internet, where our networks do not stop at Minnesota's borders, and the technical nature of the subject matter, net neutrality should be a federal, not a state issue. Minnesota has long been a leader, an innovator, and a partner with broadband providers across the state when it comes to deploying broadband and encouraging investment in the technology sector. We would ask that the committee reject this bill and continue to focus on supporting public policy that will encourage further investment, competition, innovation. And I do, again, just want to thank Representative Kraft for the amendment and for continuing to have discussions with us on our concerns on this bill. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Brent Christensen, who will be followed by Sarah Psick. Mr. Christensen, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, I'm Brent Christensen with the Minnesota Telecom Alliance.
I appreciate the opportunity to come up and testify against this bill. MTA members have long been proponents of many of the concepts of net neutrality. And let me be clear, like the Cable Association, our members do not block, throttle, engage in paid prioritization of lawful internet traffic. So if we don't do these things, then why would we have a problem with the bill? Well, let me tell you, there are two reasons. First, net neutrality is a very complicated and complex issue about how network traffic is managed by an ISP. Under this legislation, as Ms. Wolf stated, the Department of Commerce is charged with enforcing the net neutrality law. The Department of Commerce lacks the expertise to be able to tell the difference between violations of this bill and acceptable network industry network management standards. Without this highly technical skill set, there is little to no way that they'll be able to tell the difference between paid prioritization and normal network operations. Network operators will tell you that there are times that they cannot control the internet loads thrust upon their networks. Network management practices ensure customers' internet experience is as fluid as possible. Under this bill, it would be an ISP's burden to prove network management practices are reasonable or outside forces cause the network performance reduction. That adds to unnecessary regulatory burden on MTA members, many of whom, as I previously stated, are small Minnesota businesses with offices on Main Street throughout the state. Second, MTA believes that net neutrality is a federal matter and that any regulation of the internet should be enacted by the federal government. The internet, by definition, is an interstate service and under the jurisdiction of the FCC. The agency and its staff are subject matter experts who should be establishing uniform rules that apply for all 50 states. Mr. Chairman, this is where I'm going to wander a little further off from Representative Kraft's comments. I believe this is a solution in search of a problem. The examples that he gave did not happen here. Minnesota companies, I am not aware of any companies in Minnesota that have ever done anything that would be applied to this bill. And I strongly urge you to vote against the bill. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you. Our last member of the public who signed up is Sarah Pasick. Ms. Pasick.
Hi. Chair Stevenson, Representative Kraft, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Pasick, and I'm testifying on behalf of CTIA, the Trade Association for the Wireless Industry, and we are in opposition to House File 2021. CTIA and its member companies support an open internet. However, we oppose state regulation of mobile broadband, an inherently interstate service. With the FCC looking to take action in the first half of 2024 on this issue, we urge Minnesota not to move forward with this bill. Since 2018, under the current regulatory framework, U.S. wireless investment has increased for five consecutive years with a historic $39 billion invested in wireless networks in 2022 alone. The wireless broadband marketplace is providing tremendous consumer benefits. In the past 7 years, median download speeds have quadrupled while wireless prices have decreased 11% despite near historic general inflation. And it is paying off in times of need. When the COVID-19 pandemic hit, America's networks handled an unprecedented surge in mobile traffic. Of the 10 countries with the highest populations, only the United States did not experience any download speed degradation in April 2020. America's broadband providers have shown they are committed to internet openness. First, it makes business sense to provide consumers access to the content, apps, and services they want. Second, the competitive mobile broadband market demands nothing less as wireless providers give Americans unprecedented choice and access to the open internet. With the FCC taking action on this issue, Minnesota should not add to any further confusion and conflict by passing this bill. Accordingly, I respectfully ask you to not move the bill forward. And in your packet is more detailed testimony from Jared Keegan with CTIA. Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes the list of people who signed up to testify in advance. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify to this bill? Yes, sir, please come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed to your testimony.
Hello, my name is Elliot Payne, he, him. I am the president of Minneapolis City Council. I'm here in my capacity for a different item on the agenda, but I wanted to speak in support of this bill. I think net neutrality is a really critically important aspect of what brought us to the current landscape that we exist in today. Not having internet neutrality creates the conditions for even deeper walled gardens where there can be a set of haves and have-nots when it comes to the type of technology that's available to people. So I just think that we can't wait for the federal government to get this right. We know what's right here in Minnesota, and by implementing net neutrality and making sure that that's protected for everyone, I think that would be something that is absolutely something we should be moving forward with.
Thank you, Councilmember Payne. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Any other members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion and questions to the bill. Member discussion to the bill. Representative Dotsa.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Kraft. Twofold question here. Number one is why is this bill necessary with the ruling that we're waiting for from the federal government? What type of timeline are we looking at before we actually see that ruling? Number two, with your past experience with Sprint, correct? Mm-hmm. Do you see any concerns or issues with this, with interstate commerce? Any violations here at all with this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dotsiff. The first question was, why is this needed? I'll say, as I said before, that the federal government has been in and out of this when administrations changed. And one reason I'm bringing this is I believe it is an important enough concept that we should do it here. So if that happens in some future date, we have the base level of protections here. In terms of timelines, I know that they started looking at this in October of last year, and I think some view is expected sometime this year. I'm not sure of the specifics. And I have spoken to some experts in this, and they're not even sure what that will say. That may still take some time after that. So it's unclear exactly the timeline. And your second question was, based on my time at Sprint, do I have any concerns about the interstate commerce?
Well, I think,
Representative Dotsa.
Correction. I think you've got a past experience with dealing with interstate commerce. Do you see this being a potential issue with interstate commerce and a violation?
Representative Kraft, I think you might be talking about the Commerce Clause of the Constitution.
Correct, yeah.
Representative Kraft.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dotsa, I was a product manager. I wasn't a lawyer. So at this point, I don't have concerns about this, but I would bounce those to others.
Well, and I am a lawyer.
Yeah. Can I phone a friend?
I would note, Representative Dotson, if you look at Subdivision 2, Prohibitive Actions, it is with respect to the Internet Service Providers Minnesota customers. And so we often regulate economic activity in this committee and others that has an interstate component to it, but as long as the regulation relates to activities occurring in Minnesota and pertains equally, you know, doesn't treat out-of-state actors differently than in-state actors, we're generally okay with the Commerce Clause. And I think I heard Representative Kraft say that seven states have passed net neutrality across the country, some of which have been pretty heavily litigated and upheld by the Court of Appeals. I'm thinking of California. So I feel pretty comfortable about the constitutionality of this particular proposal.
Thank you, Representative Kraft.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Kraft. When I take a look at this piece of legislation, and I haven't heard yet today as to what kind of real concerns we've heard from Minnesotans as to their service being throttled, I think we've lacked some testimony to that today. My question for you is, in your research of these seven states who have adopted it and since the time at which they've adopted net neutrality, what has been the change to the costs that have been passed on to consumers and ratepayers for additional regulation for their service providers, realizing that Minnesotans are crushed under the weight of additional costs of groceries and energy costs going through the roof? I'm very concerned about the general direction that we may be placing upon Minnesota consumers and ratepayers with this bill.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schultz. So, in my looking at the other places where it has passed, I have seen no indication that there's been any impact on costs to consumers. And I will also say we heard testimony from all the folks, many of the industry folks here, that they're already doing this. So I don't see what additional cost that provides. We've actually done things in the amendments to shrink the amount of administrative overhead. So I don't see a significant or any impact on costs in Minnesota with this. And quite to the contrary, I see us putting in protections for that longer term.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So maybe the department could provide this information, but how many consumer complaints have we heard in regards to net neutrality here in Minnesota in recent years?
I don't know if Mr. Kelly, if you want to come forward and take a stab at that one.
Again, for the record, my name is John Kelly. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Department of Commerce. Chair, Representative, I don't have that at my fingertips. We can definitely look. I think, again, this is something that was regulated at the federal level and is now being contemplated to be regulated at the state level and could be regulated again at the federal level and would supersede this statute. And so I can definitely find that out. I don't, and follow up with you offline.
Representative Schultz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just understate the point that we are in need of additional information and reason for this this change to the way that we're providing service in Minnesota. More data, more information as to the need for Minnesotans and the impacts that this could have to the costs that we would all pay. People are being crushed under the weight of higher costs in today's world.
Representative Katisa Wachu.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess to just kind of follow up on Representative Schultz's point, I mean, I think that when we talk about the need to pass legislation to ensure that this doesn't ever happen in Minnesota, because it's something that we're all living with now, the companies have testified, the trade associations have testified to the fact that it's not something that they're doing, but having protection in place to ensure that it never does happen to Minnesota consumers and that we don't have to bring complaints forward and then have to react instead of being proactive, I appreciate you taking the lead on this.
Thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kraft, you had mentioned that there were seven other states that have adopted this legislation. To Representative Schultz's question of the department, I'm just going to ask you, of those seven states that have adopted this, are you familiar with the complaint history that those state regulators have received that gave them pause to want to enact a separate law other than what the federal government was doing?
Representative Kraft?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, sorry, can you clarify, am I familiar with any complaints they've received? Is that what you're asking?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, we have, Mr. Kelly wasn't able to bring anything here today, which tells me that they're minimal, if any, because if the complaints in Minnesota were noticeable enough, he would have brought that along today to share with the committee. I'm just wondering if you have any information from the other seven states that have already enacted this and their complaint history to share with the committee today while it deliberates whether or not to put in place a law that maybe doesn't need a regulation at all.
I think I'll put on my lawyer hat and say, assumes facts, not in evidence. I don't think Mr. Kelly testified that it was less or that it was minimal. I think he said he didn't know what it was at all. Representative Kraft.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Driscoll. I don't know what the complaint history is in the seven states.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, Mr. Chair, can we bring Mr. Kelly back down? Because I do have a couple questions then to clarify the discussion that he had with the committee.
You can ask Mr. Kelly any question you like, Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Kelly, has the department received any complaints at all?
Mr. Kelly.
Chair Representative, without talking to our telecom unit, and getting and asking that question of them, I can't speak definitively to that today. That's what, and that was my answer earlier to the earlier question.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. Mr. Kelly, knowing that we were going to have the hearing today, would that have been an important piece of information that the committee might have anticipated?
Yeah, we're not going to go down that particular rabbit hole there.
Please,
if
Mr.
You
Chair.
You asked your question about whether this data,
again,
you answered it twice.
Again.
If you have something else, you can ask it.
I will digress.
Mr. Kelly's meeting prep. Representative O'Driscoll.
I will digress. The point that I'm trying to make, Mr. Chair, is that we have never had anything that can be brought. No testifiers have come forth and said they personally today have experienced this. They're concerned that it might happen in the future. I have a lot of things that I'm concerned about that might happen in the future that I'd like to pass some laws as well. However, it doesn't seem to me today that we are a solution in search of to fix a problem. We have a solution in search of creating a problem, and I will just leave it at that today, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Kraft, closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. So this has happened in other locations, and based on some of the throttling that happened from AT&T and Sprint, I would surmise that it probably happened to some folks in Minnesota as well. Maybe they just didn't realize it. Some may say this is not necessary, but ISPs have shown their willingness to violate net neutrality principles, often just a little bit at a time. Now, having or not having net neutrality isn't going to make a big change in things overnight. The internet's openness is more likely to be gradually eroded, perhaps by an ISP prioritizing its own service offering, as has happened, or throttling something it doesn't like or competes with, like when Sprint throttled Skype. Bit by bit is how an open internet changes until one day we wake up and realize it's a walled-off garden and it's really only open to those with lots of money. So I didn't come in here with statistics of how many complaints have been made, but I came here with a vision for making sure that the internet stays open and fair. So it's time to do this in Minnesota, to protect an open internet with a fair and level playing field for all. And with that, I ask for your vote, and I renew my motion to refer HF 2021 to the General Register.
Representative Kraft renews his motion that House File 2021, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and House File 2021, as amended, is recommended to be placed on the General Register. The next item on our agenda today is House File 2409 by Representative Greenman. I will move House File 2409 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Greenman, to your bill.
Good afternoon, members. I have what is a simple bill. 2409 will simply increase the number of locations that Minneapolis Park Board can license alcohol, and it removes the indoor seating requirement. I'd note that it still requires the City of Minneapolis to license these locations, and the City of Minneapolis is here and supports the bill. The reason this is important, and this came up in my district actually, is right now there's only a few locations in the city. And if you look at the bill, Downtown Commons Park, Minneapolis Sculpture Island, Sculpture Garden, and Boom Island that can do this. In my district, Lake Nokomis has this beautiful outdoor venue, but it does not have enough indoor seating inside, and so it can't be licensed for alcohol. What this does is create flexibility and allows districts like mine and other places in Minneapolis to provide this service, and it allows the flexibility to meet the needs and make sure that in the summer and the spring folks can have establishments that can get a liquor permit or an alcohol permit.
Wonderful. And you have a testifier with you, Shane Stenzel. Mr. Stenzel, state your name for the record and proceed your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Yeah, thank you. Shane Stenzel, Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board. Just briefly, thank you, Representative Greenman, for introducing this. We're seeking legislation which would allow vendors and concessioners to sell alcohol in parks, provided that the park board obtains the necessary license from the City of Minneapolis. The bill would exempt Minneapolis parks from indoor seating requirements of state law so as to allow more flexibility at locations where alcohol sales could occur. This legislation is needed to respond to community requests for park board concession locations to sell alcohol where it is currently not permitted due to the lack of indoor seating that meets the state law requirement. Of note, many of these venues operate primarily in the spring and the summer months and are not built out typically like a year-round restaurant. Many of these locations have significant outdoor seating that does not count towards the state law indoor seating requirement for alcohol license.
All right. That concludes the people who signed up to testify. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, member discussion and questions to the bill. Representative O'Driscoll.
Representative Greenman, you got to be on the Representative O'Driscoll question asking day. That happens about once a session. To your bill, recently the Basilica has announced that it is bringing back its block party. and it is subsequently moving it from Basilica property to Boom Island. Can you explain how this particular bill may or may not benefit that activity for the city of Minneapolis?
The rest of the committee took note that this is the only day that Representative Driscoll will be asking questions. Glad we got that out of the way early in session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll. I assumed you meant just every session of this committee. And I saw you looking at me up there, so I was expecting a question.
Mr. Chair, could the testifier just simply answer the question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm going to turn it to our friend from the Park Board.
Mr. Stensel.
Thank you, Chair Stevens. Representative, it would be different. So Basilica Block Party is a one-day event, and we have lots of one-day events that happen in our park system, and they apply for a temporary liquor license. We are looking to do programs for longer term, for throughout the summer, that are ongoing. So this bill would address the ongoing long term. We have a solution for the short term, 1-2 day. We don't have a solution for the long term, and the long term meaning through the season.
Representative Driscoll, anything further?
So just to put some more context to this, if you were going to have a six-week music in the park kind of a program or a craft program that would go through the summer, artists in residence rotating different kinds of sculptors or painters or crafters and different things, that's what you're looking at for more than the one-hit wonders of the block party or even singular events?
Mr. Stensel.
Thank you. Yes, it would. This would be for a longer period of time. So those series, as an example, Philadelphia does a Parks on Tap series where they move from park to park. It's there for the weekend. Everything would fall under a concession agreement. So it would go through our board. We would do a concession agreement. It would go through our board versus just a 1 or 2 day liquor license that goes through the city. So everything would go through a board, have to have an agreement as well as a liquor license from the city. So for a series such as an arts in residency or a Parks on Tap or anything like that, yes, this would apply for like a 6 to 8, typically 13 weeks is what we look at for the summer months.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenman.
Can I also say the other thing that this is doing, and this is like at Lake Nokomis, is there's a concession stand that has been turned into what is essentially a restaurant. They provide food all summer and fall, and it's only open when there's outdoor seating, but it is, for all intents and purposes, a restaurant, and you wouldn't want to sit indoors in the summer. And so in addition to those described, it's also for these places that are lakes that are building out permanent facilities but just don't have that indoor seating that the current law requires.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if the answer to this is long, I'll take it offline. I hope it's short. And not so much for them, but does anybody know why we even have a requirement for indoor seating? If staff knows that, or if I don't know if anybody knows, if not, we'll take that answer offline.
House research is indicating they don't have a good answer to that question right now. I don't know. Maybe that will have to be something that has to be addressed offline. But interesting question. Yeah. Any further discussion to the bill? Seeing none, Representative Greenman, final comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the questions. I think this bill will be laid over, but I hope you consider putting it in your omnibus bill.
Thank you, Representative Greenman, and with that, the bill is laid over.
Thank you.
The next item on the agenda is House File 3336 from Representative Viernig. I will move House File 3336 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Viernig, when you are settled, you can proceed to describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. House File 3336 allows the City of Eagan to consider issuing up to 3 on-sale liquor licenses for an event center that is being planned as part of the Vikings Lakes development in District 52B. The planned facility will include full-service food and beverage both inside the venue and at the outdoor spaces. They would like to be able to serve alcoholic beverages at these spaces. MV Ventures, who is developing the project, worked with the city staff on the language, and you'll see a letter of support from the city in your packets. The bill was crafted similar to the 2017 legislation to approve on-sale liquor licenses for the Twin Cities Orthopedic Performance Center, headquarters of the Minnesota Vikings. They've been able to host many community events, some of which I've attended, since they've opened, bringing people from across the state to Eagan. I expect the new event center will provide similar opportunities for community events. As stated, this bill would allow the City of Eagan to consider issuing up to 3 on-sale liquor licenses at the event center facility that's being planned as part of the Vikings Lakes development in 52B. I will yield for testifier and comments.
All right, and we have today with us Steve Poppin. Mr. Poppin, state your name for the record and proceed your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Steve Poppin, and I serve as the Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer of MV Ventures. We develop, manage, and activate best-in-class destinations in Minnesota. MV Ventures is planning the development of a multi-use sports and event center at Viking Lakes campus in Eagan, near the Minnesota Vikings NFL training facility and the Omni Viking Lakes Hotel. The event center is intended to be a premier venue for live entertainment programming, as well as corporate conventions and other business and leisure uses. The facility will include a full-service kitchen and the ability to provide a variety of food and beverage offerings, both inside the venue and at the outdoor event spaces. The event center project is currently in the planning and design stages. The ability to obtain an on-sale liquor license is needed to move into the development phase of the project. Legislative approval is necessary before the City of Eagan may consider a liquor license application for a facility of this type. House File 3336 would grant Eagan the authority, allowing MV Ventures to seek local approval to offer on-sale liquor at the facility. MV Ventures worked collaboratively with the Office of the Eagan City Attorney on this language, and we appreciate the letter of support submitted by the city for the hearing today. We'd like to thank Representative Vernig for carrying this bill, and we hope the committee will include this language in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify to this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion and questions. Discussion to the bill. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since I'm already in the soup, I may as well stay there. Good job on your first bill.
It's my second, but it's my first in this committee, so thank you. Oh, I'm sorry.
No,
we revised that rule so that now Representative Schultz has to bring treats for everyone who brings a
freshman.
And he did that.
Yes,
he did that.
Freshman.
So we're all settled.
Get another freshman,
right? We're all good. Representative O'Driscoll.
To the testifier, I understand how liquor law works in the state of Minnesota. So on the same grounds, you can't have more than one liquor license issued. That's the Minnesota law, right? You can't have two competing bars in the same facility. You might have two different bays with two different addresses in the same strip mall, two different businesses. What's going to be unique about this that would require in the same facility that current law wouldn't allow to have a suite, a bay that would be able to be identified by a different parcel number and or address that the Eagan City Council could issue a liquor license independent of the other two?
Mr. Poppin.
I want to make sure I'm
yes
clear on what you're asking. So we're asking for more than one liquor license. Is that your point, is the 3 liquor licenses that we're asking for?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm just getting clarification. On the same complex
yep
physical grounds, we're looking to be able to issue up to 3 separate entities a liquor license.
Yep.
Is the design of that entity going to be that it's one open room where you'd have the foul of, wait a second, that's one facility, that's one liquor license, or are we going to have multiple separate addresses on the complex facility where the current law would still allow us to be able to issue individual liquor licenses to different proprietors?
Yep.
Mr.
Chair, Representative, with respect to the addresses, I'm not sure I can speak to that, but I know within the design of the building itself, we are looking at the opportunity to have different venues, which may different sub venues within the facility, which may require us or we may desire to have different operators for each of those particular items. We may have food service, as an example, inside the facility that services the concerts. We may have another provider that provides the food service and our outdoor events. So that's the reason that we're looking for flexibility with up to 3 licenses. It all depends on how we ultimately work through this with the city, but we're looking for flexibility in case we need separate licenses for the separate subsections within the event center.
Last question, and this should help clarify. So a caterer's license is probably not something that you're looking for because you want to have that individual or beyond that flexibility. That answers my question.
All right. Any further questions? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Vernig, one, as a fellow freshman, and then also as someone who is just adores the Minnesota sports team that happens to occupy your district, I'm pleased to bring these cookies to you from the Egan Costco right in your district. And so there's a full round left for the rest of the members of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. All right, seeing no further discussion, closing comments, Representative Fernig.
Thank you, Chair and members, for your time and consideration. It's a good bill for business, and it's a good bill for the city of Egan and for all of the Vikings fans as well.
All right, and with that, the bill is laid over. The last item on our agenda today is House File 3490 from Representative Becker Finn. I will move House File 3490 be recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. Representative Becker Finn, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Going to take us in a different direction. right now in the state of Minnesota, it is legal to buy and sell human bones for commercial profit. You could walk into an oddities shop not that far from here today and buy a human skull. I know this because a former constituent brought this to my attention when they visited such a store, walked in, and was appalled that they were marketing human bones for sale. Reached out to me, was like, is this legal? We looked into it further, and it turns out it's not addressed in Minnesota statute. And so you can, and if you wanted to pull up your phone right now, you could even look up, there is a handout in your packets, a quick Google, and you can purchase a human skull on the internet and other bones that obviously was somebody's loved one at some point. So after looking into it further and finding out that it was not addressed in statute, we had this bill drafted to make sure that it would be illegal if this bill were to be passed. So if you look at line 1.9, we define human remains for the purposes of this bill as the calcified portion of a dead human body because we are specifically addressing the sale of bones because that is a practice that we know is actively happening right now in our state. So it may seem obvious, but I, as someone who teaches legislative process, I'm now always thinking about the legislative record. So it seems obvious, but I do want to state why it's necessary that we make this change, although I am hoping most of you agree with me already. I would guess for most of us, it is simply just against our own sense of morality and respect for other human beings, the dignity we believe anyone should be treated with, both in life and death. For myself, as a Native person, there is a long history of Native remains and bones being displayed, sold, brokered, and otherwise used for, I guess, entertainment, as well as collector purposes. Obviously, I find that commodification of a human being reprehensible, and I would hope that we all would. There are even still bones of ancestors dug up and displayed and held in institutions and individuals in our state today. So this bill, though, deals specifically with the sale. So if somebody already has bones or has inherited them somehow, if you have, you know, the cremains of a loved one, this wouldn't apply to that. This is about selling calcified remains. Before we move on, I want to address the letter in your packets from the Minnesota Catholic Conference. The letter, while undoubtedly drafted with good intentions, is misleading and logically false. It draws some conclusions that are simply not accurate if you look at the definitions within the bill. The bill does not make it legal to sell body parts. That's not the goal here. The bill only addresses calcified remains one way or the other. It does not address other human remains and other body parts and things that we may all be concerned about. The reality is that the sale of body parts is not addressed in Minnesota statute. I would welcome anyone wanting to work on that specific issue, but that's not this bill today in front of us. The sale of organs is covered briefly in Minnesota statute in 145.422, but otherwise our statutes are currently silent. So that is the bill, and I know we've got a couple testifiers and would welcome discussion after that.
Wonderful. So we will go to the testimony at this point. We have Joe Selwood from the Minnesota Funeral Directors Association. Mr. Selwood, come forward, state your name for the record, proceed your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Commerce Committee. I am testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Funeral Directors Association in support of House File 3490 legislation to prohibit the sale of human remains. The more than 600 funeral directors who make up MFDA's membership strongly believe that human remains should be treated with dignity and respect. The buying and selling of human remains for profit beyond their reasonable value related to funeral rites and final disposition goes against our customs, which is to uphold dignity in death. As a society, we treat our deceased with respect by laying them properly to rest. That is how we honor them even after their passing. Absent a bright line, there remains a quiet but open market for the buying and selling of human remains, gathered as morbid collectibles or used for questionable purposes. This bill takes the first necessary step against this trade. House File 3490 would prohibit disturbing outcomes by setting a clear standard around the sale of remains. We believe this approach strikes the right balance by permitting existing legitimate uses while protecting human dignity. Dealing with the broader issue of body brokers, the National Funeral Directors Association is working on passage of federal legislation that requires registration of entities, disclosure to the next of kin throughout the entire process, and additionally, it establishes chain of custody requirements and standards for final disposition and return of the remains. So we thank Chair Becker-Finn for leading on this issue and to the committee for considering the input of the funeral directors. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Selwood. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, we'll move on. We do, I believe, have one amendment that Representative Brindley wants to offer. You can offer the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would offer the, let's see here, it's the A1 amendment. Move the A1 amendment. And great. I'll speak to the amendment. This basically, what it does is this essentially removes the it removes the exceptions to the bill. Of course, to your point, I do appreciate the bill. I think we all do. My concern, though, is, as you mentioned, the commodifying of human body parts. We shouldn't do that at all. And this does, by allowing these exceptions, we do still allow for the commodifying of these body parts. I looked up, I just Googled it. There was an article from CBS News last year that said that there are approximately 20,000 bodies donated to science each year. And that's every year, not just in that year, or not in totality. And it seems like that is probably a better way to continue. I'm really concerned about any exceptions to commodifying the sale of these body parts. And clearly it would just apply to bones and teeth effectively, right? Because at least, I guess, maybe I'm wrong, but I can't imagine a use for the cremated remains or hydrolyzed remains. So I would hope that this is viewed as a friendly amendment, and I would request a yes vote. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would oppose the amendment, and I'm going to tell you why. So we can lay out what those exceptions are. One is for a licensed healthcare provider or a post-secondary educational institution for legitimate medical or scientific purposes or for educational purposes. The second exception is something we actually were in contact with law enforcement. And law enforcement, if you're going to train a cadaver dog, you need the correct item for the dog to smell if you're going to try to find remains. And so that was a request from law enforcement that that exception be included. And then the third one is that it's incidental to the sale of real property, including undisturbed burial plots, cemeteries, crypts, or burial features. So I understand the concern, and I agree that we don't want to create a practice. We wouldn't be. These are legitimate uses that are already happening. However, if we do have another committee stop, and if you wanted to talk about putting some further parameters similar to what's in 145.422 regarding separate statute about human organs, that specifically states, you know, you can reimburse somebody for their trouble, essentially. So I would be open to that. That's not the amendment that's in front of us, but I would be open to that and discussing it further for our next committee stop. I just think a wholesale removal of the exceptions is going to create more problems than it solves.
Further discussion to the A1. Representative Newbrindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Becker-Finn. I do appreciate those comments. Yeah, ultimately, I mean, it's our, there's a prohibition. Actually, the prohibition right now on organs is specifically for transplantation or therapy. And so it, I mean, really, absent including language about those non-calcified remains, right, tissue, organs, that kind of thing, I do have other concerns, and maybe we can talk about that moving forward as well. It does make sense to me to modify this to allow for those expenses that may be associated with donation, and I appreciate your willingness to work on that moving forward.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the A1 amendment say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Discussion to the bill. Representative O'Driscoll.
Representative Becker-Finn, thank you for bringing this bill forward. This may be the first time in our legislative career that we actually agree on a topic that's in front of committee, which is okay. We have found something all these years. It's a good way to be a good spot. The question that I have and I need clarification on is lines 210 through 214 in the bill. Tell me currently, how does law enforcement acquire cadavers for canine training purposes?
Chair Becker-Finn.
Thank you. I'm going through my notes to see if I have that specifically right in front of me. I don't think I do, but I know that we talked to DPS and we talked to law enforcement about that, and this was language that they were comfortable with. I'm certain we can find that out. I would assume that they're donated. I wouldn't see any reason why you would need to, or who would even be selling them. Again, this bill in front of us only addresses calcified remains. So I suppose if they needed bones from somewhere and the only way place they could get them was one of these shops or something like that, I don't know. But we can certainly find that out with further discussion with law enforcement.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the to Representative Becker-Finn, I would assume that it's donated as well. I mean, I know a lot of people say, well, when I die, my body's going to the University of Minnesota for that. Still waiting for my first person to say that I'm going to be a cadaver dog trainee, you know. But I suppose it could happen. I don't mean that to necessarily be funny, because I respect the dignity of people and the dignity of death, as you talked about on this. To the point of the bill, I like the direction it's going. I plan on supporting it today. I'm also hoping that there's a way that we can find a way to clarify and define these other exceptions in here so we don't have to go back and go, what is this what that meant, or is this what that meant, just so we've got them clearer for legislative interpretation if someone challenges that at some point in the future. Lines 213 through 214, I believe, are also already covered in Minnesota law, where when there's interned remains on property, the purchaser of that property does not own the rights to those remains. They, as a matter of fact, agree to leave them undisturbed on said property and on said premises. And if for some reason, for public health or other, they literally have to go to court to get the court's permission to be able to exhume and relocate those remains into a different burial site. So I think that that's already covered. So I'm just wondering if there's a way that we can work through some of the concerns that others have, the Catholic Conference and others that may have this. Because I don't, for the 1 minute, think selling human body parts is something that is, well, it's just disgusting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll say the same way that you're asking for sort of some comfort language around some things, that was something that talking with funeral directors and real estate professionals, just to make it clear that, okay, so, you know, this is why we have committee process, you know, so people ask questions. Well, what if I bought something and I'm sort of therefore buying the bones because they're in the, you know, they wanted to make sure that there was that clarification. Like I said, I'm happy to talk about ways to fine-tune this so that folks feel more comfortable. But I think the main thrust of the Catholic Conference letter is actually about a separate but related issue, which is obviously disturbing, also would be in favor of moving that forward. The reason this bill is focused solely on bones is because that is actually happening right now. Sort of your comment earlier about a solution in search of a problem, this is a problem that we know is happening right now. And in our conversations with law enforcement and funeral directors and others, to our knowledge, it's not, there's no rampant selling of human body parts here in Minnesota right now. So I think, you know, that might be a discussion for a separate bill to address that issue now that we've sort of brought it to the forefront. And then I will also note quickly that we were already working on this bill when the news of the Twin Cities man who was pled guilty in federal court to purchasing human remains. And that's sort of a separate issue involving the Harvard morgue and some really to use your word, disgusting and deplorable actions by folks in some other states. But interestingly, I went and looked at the complaint, and that was actually a trafficking of stolen goods case, because this issue of just the actual sale of body parts and bones just isn't something that we should incentivize or encourage in any way. It's just not actually addressed in law. Surprising, because it's just so obvious, but it it's not under law. And so that's the federal level legislation that Mr. Selwood mentioned that funeral directors nationwide are seeking would address that. And I think certainly supportive of those efforts.
All right. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Becker-Finn. You've sort of answered this question, but I would just go one step further. I am concerned that this is limited to calcified portion of a dead human body. And you mentioned that, you know, we know that right now that definitively is happening. I guess I would just ask, do we know definitively that the sale of other human remains is not happening?
Chair Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You can't prove a negative. But I know in the conversations we've been working on this bill actually for a couple months, almost since session ended last year when it was brought to my attention. In all the conversations we've had with folks, nobody's aware of it happening. That doesn't mean it's not happening. I agree with you. But, I mean, we couldn't find a case where it had been prosecuted or investigated that it was happening. And certainly we've had assurance from the Funeral Directors Association that, you know, they all are very professional in taking this issue seriously. But I can't prove a negative. We narrowed the language to calcified remains because we knew if it was more than that, we would be having even bigger conversations that would be more complicated and maybe make it harder to land on language to actually move forward about the thing that's happening. There's actually a big expo that happens every year in the Twin Cities. There's an oddities expo that historically over the years has sold human remains at that event. So it would be my hope that we can move this forward and get this passed before that event happens so that it would curtail that practice happening here in the Twin Cities this year.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Becker-Finn. I appreciate your honesty on that. My concern, and I'll be honest, I'm going to vote no on this today. And the reason for that is, you know, I mean, we just saw a relatively high profile case at the federal level where the absence of language implied legality. And my concern is that by specifically not including other tissues and organs, that there could be a legal interpretation that that is allowable under this law. And like I said, I mean, we just recently saw a very high-profile case regarding the absence of language. And so I do think it is really critical to include that. And again, this does not affect, I mean, if we outlawed the commodifying of body parts, cadavers, et cetera, it still allows for donation for the purpose of law enforcement, for legitimate medical and scientific purposes. And we know actually, like I said, that, I mean, tens of thousands of bodies are donated each year for that purpose. So I think we are still fulfilling those needs that we have. But I really am concerned about the absence of language being used to create something as legal that would not be our intention. Thank you.
And Chair Beckerfin, I'll give the chance to respond and also ask that you make any closing comments you have at that time as well, as we have no other members seeking recognition. Chair
Beckerfin. Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would say, you know, the first thing, and you know this by now, you know, the first thing you do is go look at the definitions and what the definitions are. And I think the definitions are really clear that for the purposes of this bill, we are talking about calcified portions of a human body. And so I understand the concern, but I don't think by saying one thing is illegal, we're necessarily implying that other things are allowed. And I think further, it's already legal. It's legal right now. So this bill doesn't legalize something that is currently illegal. It's silent to that because, again, I believe it's a separate but related issue. I am happy to bring this bill forward because, again, practically speaking, we are focused on the thing that we know is happening and we want to stop that practice. And I would hope that all members would feel comfortable supporting that. If folks want to work further, I know I have already talked to a couple members who might be interested in carrying a separate bill to address the other issue. I would be fully supportive of that. I just believe that these are two separate and distinct, although related, issues. So, again, the sale of human bones is currently legal in the state of Minnesota. The question before us is, do we want to make that practice illegal? And that this bill would do that. And so I would welcome members voting in favor of moving it forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 3490 be recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety Finance and Policy Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and House File 3490 is recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety Finance and Policy Committee. Before we adjourn, I just want to remind members it's helpful to our staff if you remove any papers from these green folders. It makes their lives a lot easier, so if you could pull those out, that's really helpful to them. And with that, there's no further business before the committee, and so the committee is adjourned.